The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone. I'm Andrew Loker, giving my second ever program here in Edstone, coming from the attic apartment that's just really very functional and beautiful. I think I mentioned the last time I was here, there's a window that just allows you to look out into the millennial landscape that's here in Britain. The weather's been unseasonably warm. It's been just very enjoyable, to say the least. Yesterday, Mr. Stephen Fleury, your regular host, gave a very inspiring program from Jerusalem. There was, of course, the insightful news coverage, and it just kind of really struck me what a marvelous work we're a part of, where God sends his news gatherers all over the planet. One day, Mr. Stephen Fleury is in Edstone giving his first ever, or really the church's first ever, online campaign with huge success. Such meaningful and excited feedback from those that came aboard and participated in that campaign. And then the very next day, even with some travel drama, he's reporting from Jerusalem. It's miraculous how God responded to the prayers of his people and the faith of Mr. Fleury. They're able to make it down to Tel Aviv, as we heard yesterday on the program, and then they'll be coming back today. I'm just amazed at what we're a part of. One of the more highly respected journalists that we follow, having dinner with Mr. Fleury and the crew there, having some light conversation, interview with our staff, Mrs. Melanie Phillips, that is, just really a spectacular project that we're a part of. So I do encourage you to please listen to the program tomorrow, including Mr. Fleury's interview with Melanie Phillips. It should be a really special program. Well, I hosted a few days ago after the online campaign, and I have to say I was just still really riveted by yesterday's TDR program. It's very thrilling to analyze the results, our biggest campaign ever, all of those comments, more than 30 different countries. We have different analytical tools to examine response and to look at our website traffic, and it's always inspiring to me to look at the number of countries. This is a small world, a number of countries, I should say, that tune in and follow God's message. It's a small world. It has to be warned. And God does do that through this program and others. Now, we learned a lot in the live online environment that we use. That was new for us. We've, of course, done other live events. And we do hope to have a cleaner production down the road the next time we do this. And again, we're all hoping that we can do more of these. But really, it was quite an accomplishment for the students and the employees of God's work. There is a fantastic team assembled at headquarters at Edstone, down in Jerusalem, Australia, Canada, all over the world. Even this morning, actually, I guess it was last night, Mr. Richard Palmer sent me a Word document that had all of this news prepared. Such a terrific team. Now, I'm not going to be able to use his efforts because I still need to finish up what I was talking about in the previous program. But if you look at what's done from here at Edstone, it is a beautiful facility, but we take care of a lot of social media projects. The foreign language translation program is led from here. All the trumpet material is worked on here, and it's spread between headquarters and Edstone. They produce television here. Of course, the college is here. They beautify the campus. There's so much going on. And it's really led and directed, obviously, by Gerald Fleury. And then with Mr. Stephen Fleury, he's very ambitious with programming. He looks for ways to help us to magnify his Father's voice all over the world. And so we appreciate that push. And again, we just really thank you for your prayers to help us be as effective as we can on the production side of things. As I mentioned, Mr. Fleury and the crew will fly back from Tel Aviv to Birmingham this afternoon. They have a quick overnight rest here and then off to Scotland for a college activity. The next day, Gerald Fleury returns back to Edmond after a very busy schedule. And we all know how important this work is. And it is a global work that did take Gerald Fleury down to the nation of Israel. He's been here in England. He'll return to Edmond. and then off to a campaign in a couple weeks. And so really, it is quite an effective and very busy time of year for us. I wanted to just mention that last year, the church spent nearly $600,000 on projects related to Israel. The Noctegal family lives in Jerusalem and takes care of our office needs there. They represent the church all through the year, all over Israel. They live in an apartment that allows our staff to cram in there with their family when they visit, just like right now. Mr. Brad McDonald travels to Israel occasionally to work with the various contacts that we have down there, including, of course, Dr. Mazar. Mr. Stephen Fleury gets down to Jerusalem, and we continue to support our foundation there and support the works of Dr. Mazar. You might remember a coworker letter that Mr. Fleury wrote last year, and really it was just very inspiring to see the response from our members, from our coworkers, a lot of excited comments, and even a strong financial response that enabled us to carry on with our projects there. The exhibit that is hosted at Armstrong Auditorium of the Boule of Hezekiah and Isaiah is running its final couple of weeks before those Boule are returned to Israel. We've had over 6,100 visitors to the exhibit. And as we all know, it's just a tremendous testimony to this king-prophet relationship and on display right there in Edmond. Let's not forget the significance of that exhibit. Perhaps one of the greatest archaeological discoveries ever. And it debuted right there in Armstrong Auditorium. It's still there. And again, when you think about everything we're talking about here, the students have been part of that process. We're all, of course, praying for new opportunities to come out of this visit from Mr. Fleury down to Jerusalem. Mr. Shane Granger sent me a message yesterday to inform me that he's seeking some information, but he's entering our exhibit into a competition that is going to draw attention to the most outstanding temporary exhibit. And he's done a fantastic job bringing a lot of positive reputation to God's work there in Edmond and really all over the world. Our concert series has had record-breaking attendance for the first season. And so there's just so many fruits. Well, I've really enjoyed my time here at Edstone. We have about a dozen students assisting God's work in the United Kingdom, Europe, and the Middle East. We've been working on the studio relocation, trying to make the most out of the space in this beautiful building. Mr. McDonald and his staff and students that work very hard to save money and to really provide a very professional environment. So we just ask that you pray about the production studios for radio, for television, for these internet-based messages, and for our British campus. We're really trying to get the most out of this that we can. Well, we'll take a break in just a second. And when we return, I want to take up where I left off the other day as we look at the details surrounding the Green New Deal.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Throughout the Bible, God uses his material creation as a vital instrument through which he communicates with mankind.
The scene is nothing short of apocalyptic.
We have nothing left.
The so-called natural disasters we see increasing are, in fact, a tool that the creator of the natural world has reserved for himself to use in order to speak with us.
We have been praying for quite a while now for the eye to pass over so we can get some kind of a break.
Severe natural phenomena are impossible to ignore. Yet for most people, even as our planet is coming apart, the message is still not resonating.
Tonight, along the Texas Gulf Coast, utter devastation. In the town of Rockport, entire blocks are decimated.
The question is, are you prepared to listen?
You know, this is of biblical proportions, Fred. Take a look around me.
Our town is destroyed, and it hurts.
Jesus Christ listed nature-related disasters as being a sign of his imminent return. Request the free booklet, Why Natural Disasters, so that you can discern the signs of the times. To order our free booklet, email your request to td@kpcg.fm. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back. Fortune magazine ran a story 2 days ago citing a report from a conservative think tank that suggests the Green New Deal could cost, hold on to your seat here, between $50 and $95 trillion over a 10-year implementation period. The costs just keep going up and up and up. One of the main contributors to this report is a former CBO director, the Congressional Budget Office. He was a director of that government accounting team, you could say, that analyzes some of the anticipated costs for proposed legislation. So the report was put together by somebody with some pretty meaningful credentials. The story of the Green New Deal stays or remains in the news cycle and will likely continue to do so for quite some time. As I concluded the last program on this subject, I noted that this is not just an economic or political issue. It gets down to character. And of course, the lawless, live without concern of penalty lifestyle sounds so appealing to humanity. Everybody likes the thought of getting something for free. And yet after 6,000 years, that remains an unlearned lesson of mankind. It does make for a popular political campaign trying to just provide all of these free services. I like to refer to it as ponies and rainbows for everybody. The Green New Deal sounds so positive, so happy and fair for everybody. But that's only on the surface. Those are words. As I brought out previously, the original New Deal and the subsequent related legislation are plagued by bad math, by low estimates. And as I read on the last program, I think it was from Forbes magazine, it says that we're still paying for that New Deal. Decades in the past. Now, mankind seems to have a weakness for immediate gratification, and that's at the core of this deal. However, as I said last program too, selfishness or the getaway of life is unsustainable. You can't operate a society, a family, a life where it's based on getting. This isn't a new movement that's being put forward. I'm going to play for you two audio clips that really speak to this socialist argument. I made the first clip a little bit longer because, one, I think it's important to listen to what she says, but it's also rather humorous. It makes a great point, though, about living history, about looking at the facts. The first clip that we'll listen to is from Margaret Thatcher, and she's addressing the House of Commons on November 22nd, 1990. We'll listen to clip one, please.
I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
Eminent Finchley.
There is no doubt that the Prime Minister has in many ways achieved substantial success for the economy. Yeah. There is one statistic that I understand is not, however, challengeable, and that is that over her 11 years, the gap between the richest 10% and the poorest 10% in this country has widened substantially.
That's right.
How can she say at the end of her chapter of British politics that she can justify many people in a constituency such as mine being relatively much poorer off, much less well housed, and much less well provided than it was in 1979? Surely she accepts that is not a record that she or any Prime Minister can be proud of.
Mr. Speaker, all levels of income are better off than they were in 1979. But what the Honourable Member is saying is that he would rather the poor were poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That way you will never create the wealth for better social services as we have. And what a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That is a liberal policy. Yes, it came out. He didn't intend it to, but he did.
I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I'm extremely grateful. The Prime Minister is aware that I detest every single one of her domestic policies and have never had that.
I think that the Honourable Gentleman knows that I have the same contempt for his socialist policies as the people of East Europe who have experienced it have it for theirs.
I think I must have hit the right nail on the head when I pointed out that the logic of those policies are they'd rather have the poor poorer. Once they start to talk about the gap, they'd rather the gap were that. Down here. That. Not that. But that. So long as the gap is smaller, so long as the gap is smaller, they'd rather have the poor poorer. You do not create wealth and opportunity that way. You do not create a property-owning democracy that way.
What a great commentary. That's not a solution. History has proven it not to be a solution. We can narrow the gap between the rich and the poor, but to do that, it takes the whole system down. History proves socialism doesn't work. A smaller gap in income equality does not provide an economic solution. Now, the second clip that I want to play to you comes from Stuart Varney. He was giving an opinion piece here on Fox News Channel in April 2012. Mr. Varney is a business contributor that sometimes is a substitute for Mr. Neil Cavuto. And Mr. Varney is a British native. His commentary addresses the morality of socialism. Just a few facts about this sounds very similar to what was promoted by the liberals in Washington. So we'll listen to clip two.
Wake up Monday morning and you may well see a far-left socialist on his way to becoming the president of France, Monsieur François Hollande. He wants to order, not ask, order the central bank to print a lot more money. He wants a lower retirement age and a 75% tax rate on the rich. Watch out, mes amis. Financial lunacy lives on. You can see in this the sheer desperation to keep the gravy train going. No matter what it does to your economy, no matter what it does to your culture, instead of reform, there is a great yearning for a return to the good old days of something for nothing and someone else can pay. That is the morality of socialism, or rather the immorality. What the French and other Europeans do not accept is that this absolutely cannot go on, and the crunch has arrived. You can delay it a bit by printing money, but that makes the crash far worse in the end. We don't spend much time talking about the Europeans on this program. Frankly, we're bored with them, and I'm bored of reporting their financial follies of the continent of my birth. But when it's going to hurt us, we will tell you all about it. So let me close with the age-old truth from that great lady, Margaret Thatcher. Here we go. The trouble with socialism is that sooner or later, you run out of other people's money.
Again, great, great wisdom. Just looking at history, looking at the world around us, looking at the desperation of mankind. See, that is the problem with this Green New Deal. There isn't enough money to even give it a try. And while some politicians like Kamala Harris or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, while they encourage us to look beyond the cost, we're not even going to put the cost down on paper. They want us to embrace the ideology. However, there's still a present reality that we must live with. How will this ever work in the real world? Going back to that magazine quote from Fortune magazine just 2 days ago, they said the so-called Green New Deal may tally between $51 to $95 trillion over 10 years, concluded the American Action Forum. That includes between $8 trillion and $12 trillion to meet the plan's call to eliminate carbon emissions from the power and transportation sectors, and between $40 to $80 trillion for its economic agenda, including providing jobs and health care for all. There was a bill, if I recall correctly, a bill introduced in the House of Representatives yesterday, again, calling for this Medicare for all. $40 to $80 trillion. There is no way the nation can afford anything close to that, even if it is spread over 10 years. And again, I remind you, if you look back historically, the actual costs had outstripped by maybe tenfold the projected costs. But I want to focus the remainder of today's program on the energy and transportation issue with the Green New Deal. To set the stage, I want to go back and play a clip from Gerald Fleury, which we played just a couple of days ago. This was a Key of David program in 2017, so we'll play clip three now.
I don't want to talk to you about political views today,
except one, and it is a deadly, deceptive view that is going to affect every single one of us if we believe it. There was an ex-U.S. Secretary of State that recently talked about this subject on television. And he said that all of these violent storms that you see around America and the world are caused by climate change. Now, that is just about the most deadliest deception you could possibly hear, and I want to show you why. There are many others that have that view. They have it, they believe it, but today I want to bring God's view into this climate change controversy.
Now, as you're familiar with, there has been a lot of discussion in the media about climate change. And I think in a sense, a lot of it is so laughable because the media and the liberal politicians try to pin so much of the disaster and the horror of the storms on one man, on President Donald Trump. I mean, really, this one man is causing all of these problems? Yes, we pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord in June 2017. And I don't want to play the game that the media does by exaggerating what they say or the facts they present. There's no denying that the media have lost a sensible approach to the crumbling world around us, to these natural disasters. Even if the general public is in support of this, again, I think it just reflects a woeful, uneducated perspective. Now, apparently, the American people are growing increasingly concerned about this, the role of climate change in our lives. And again, this is if we are to believe the media. I'm going to quote a poll from the New York Times. And outside of just being fake news, as we've talked about, you could almost say that they're the lying news. But on January 22nd, 2019, the New York Times said a record number of Americans understand climate change is real. Some 73% of Americans polled late last year said that global warming was happening. So congratulations, America. You've woken up to the fact that the nation is under curses. We are being cursed. At least we're recognizing that fact. But the problem is we're not addressing the cause. You can't blame one man. You can't blame legislation. You can't look for a quick solution. And again, they'll try to argue their way around that. So one of the most hotly contested goals of the Green New Deal revolves around the reduction of carbon emissions. Let's consider this concept of dramatically reducing carbon emissions. Scientists have identified those emissions as the leading cause of climate change, and it's no longer called global warming. And perhaps that's because we're seeing record cold. This morning, I saw on the Drudge Report that the Los Angeles area had its coldest February in 60 years. That was reported by Breitbart. And a subsequent story or a follow-up story behind that produced by the Weather Channel said that they're expecting 10 feet of snow at the Sierra Nevada or in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And so we're having record cold, we're having record snowfall, but of course the planet is suffering from global warming. And so they can't use that misnomer anymore. Now it's talking about climate change. And the climate has changed. Who controls the climate? That's what the Key of David program is about. Even the advertisement that played during this program about our Why Natural Disasters book, all of that explains what's going on. I encourage you to visit thetrumpet.com, to explore our resources there, to request this literature, to download it, to read it, and understand what's causing these problems. I want to quote to you from an Energy Outlook report that was produced by ExxonMobil. And they were projecting the energy use from 2018 through 2040. So they're trying to look into the future some. And they are projecting a big problem for the Green New Deal. Now, again, this is from Big Oil, you might say, and the Green New Dealers or the environmentalists might accuse them, and perhaps rightfully so, protecting their business. But just listen to some of these facts that they present. They expect between 2018 and 2040 for a 25% increase in energy needs. So we need more energy, and that just makes sense. And they really focus a lot on these non-OECD companies or countries, excuse me. That's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And if you look at who the members are of that, it's mostly the Western nations, the developed nations of the world. So they're saying that while we're trying to plane out or level off our energy use, if you start looking at countries like China and India and some of the underdeveloped areas around the world, they're likely to increase their energy needs in the coming years. This report says that global electricity demand will rise 60% between 2018 and 2040. So a huge increase in need for electricity, 60% increase. Natural gas is perhaps the biggest culprit, or coal, I guess, fossil fuels for contributing these gases into the environment. They say here that natural gas use is likely to increase more than any other energy source, about half of its growth for electricity generation. And they also say here that oil plays a role to aid mobility and modern products. It says growing demand driven by commercial transportation and the chemical industry. So what this report is getting at is in the coming decades, we're going to need more energy, more mobility, and the only known resources that we really have for this are the ones that are the greatest contributors to the problem. So how do you carry forward with that? This report says continued economic growth, particularly in these non-OECD countries, will result in increased demand for all transportation services. Nuclear demand grows 70% between 2016 and 2040, all of it led by China. So they're looking to nuclear energy as well. So let's talk again about the reality of what we're dealing with. This world requires a lot of energy to exist. We've become so reliant on technology. We're reliant on cheap energy. But what happens when that energy isn't abundantly available? What happens if the cost increases? What happens in a world like that? Well, again, we can look back in history. We can look back even to the 1970s and the energy crisis that affected so many of the Western nations. And a lot of it was caused by a shortage in the petroleum industry. So it makes sense if you're trying to solve these problems, it makes sense to a carnal mind to do away with the greatest influence in climate change. If the fossil fuels use is creating this problem, then they have to go, right? They are the proven culprits of CO2 emissions. Let me read to you here. This is from the Environmental Protection Agency, and this is a report, I believe, from 2017. And just to summarize here, they're talking about global emissions by economic sector. So the use of fossil fuels, where are they used predominantly? Well, electricity and heat production account for 25% of the use of fossil fuels, another 14% going to transportation. The Green New Deal calls for doing away with fossil fuel use. They don't like coal. They don't like natural gas. They don't like petroleum products. And they want to focus on renewable energy sources. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. And what they're going to have to do is rely on an increase of nuclear energy. 39% of all the gas emissions are created by fossil fuels. And the Green New Deal calls out in particular transportation and electricity use. I won't go on here with this. You could study into some of those facts on your own. So who contributes? We brought this out a number of times before. Any person with a sound mind would say, okay, if these carbon emissions are so catastrophic to the climate, and undoubtedly there is some damage done there, well, we should fix the problem with the biggest contributor of carbon emissions to the atmosphere, shouldn't we? It doesn't make sense to go after the little nations. So who produces the most carbon? Well, the United States likes to hang itself, right? We're the bad ones in the world, but that is not true. China, as probably you've heard, China produces three times the amount of carbon emissions as the United States. In fact, if you take the next seven countries below China, they don't even contribute as much as China does. It's China's the biggest producer, the United States, the entire European Union, India, Russia, Japan, Germany. You combine all of their emissions, and it's only 71% of what China is putting into the atmosphere. Forbes magazine in 2016 noted that China emits more CO2 than the US and the EU combined. And their needs are the ones that are projected to grow the most. So what is the solution then? It's a beautiful sunny day outside in England, but if you've been here long, if you live here long, it gets cloudy. It's always nice when we visit, but it does get cloudy here. I'm looking at the trees outside now, that not a rustle of the leaves. There's no wind out there. It is sunny today, though. So can we look to sun and wind? Well, what are some of the obstacles to those types of energy generation? First and foremost, this is a report from the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's a group that's together Science for a Healthy Planet and a Safer World. So in March 2017, they list some of the barriers to renewable energy technology. The first, capital cost. They acknowledge that the fuel is free, wind and solar, but the installation costs for those types of generation systems are anywhere from 20 to 40% more than a similar output from a fossil fuel source. The most obvious and widely publicized barrier to renewable energy is cost, specifically the upfront expense of building and installing solar and wind farms. So here we go, coming back to the reality of money. We could talk about renewable energy sources and how that would solve all of our problems. Who's going to pay for their installation? The second obstacle they list is called siting and transmission. They say nuclear power, coal, and natural gas are all highly centralized sources of power, meaning they rely on relatively few high-output power plants. So our existing technology that we use to generate electricity, it is centralized, and they're able to invest a lot in small areas and meet the needs. You've probably read stories or seen examples of the size of the solar panels, the distribution of solar or wind-generated equipment all over the country. I've driven from Oklahoma to Colorado, and several times as you make that drive, it's a windy zone, but you see these very ugly wind farms, just as far as the eye can see, blinking red lights so the aircraft don't run into them. Solar panels, again, have their issues. Sitting, it's basically, I won't get into that for sake of time, but transmission. How do you move the power from the wind turbines or the solar panels into the infrastructure where they need to use the electricity? Well, it's not the same because it's decentralized. So you have these vast wind farms all over, and you're supposed to collect the power and bring it to the city. Well, we don't have those kind of transmission lines in place. Power generation plants, nuclear or fossil, are typically located very close to major energy requiring areas. This says to adequately take advantage of these resources, new transmission infrastructure is needed. So we're going to have more power lines. Who's going to pay for those? Are we going to bury them so they're not visible? That's even more expensive. This report says for most of the last century, U.S. electricity was dominated by certain major players, including coal, nuclear, and recently natural gas. And they hold enormous market power. And then the report goes on to talk about the big problem here is the United States subsidizes fossil fuel to the tune of billions of dollars every year. The lobbies that support this energy source, Exxon and some of the fossil fuel industry, they have tremendous wealth and lobbying power. And so we'll spend more money arguing about it, more money installing it, and then we end up with a less than adequate system to fuel our growing needs. Now, there's other obvious questions. When was the last time you got on an electric airplane and flew over the Atlantic? How come most cars are not electric? I saw a source that 30% of American car buyers consider purchasing an electric car. 30%, that's a lot. But only 3% buy one. What does it come down to? Cost. Just 2% of the cars sold in the United States in 2018 were electric. 2%. So if we follow through with the Green New Deal legislation, we must replace 98% of the cars. That's just unthinkable. Who's going to pay for that? Now, I could go on and on about the problems we're talking about. And that's what Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is dealing with. You start asking these questions, and then all of a sudden the plan does not appear viable at all. And we're not even estimating the real cost. You could talk about ideology all you want, but who's going to pay for the installation? It's costly, and nobody has money for it. The options are there now for some solutions, but they're still a hard sell. We'll take one more short break here, and when we come back, I want to talk about the nuclear option or the use of nuclear energy. We don't want to blow things up. So we'll take a short break, and we'll come back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Well, thank you for staying with me this long in the program. I'm definitely not trying to be cynical. I'm not trying to make fun of the proposed legislation. There are real problems affecting this world. There are economic failures all over the world. There are problems with our food, with our environment, with energy production. There is abuse of those that have tremendous wealth or resources. It is a real problem, and it is noble in a sense to try to bring about the ponies and rainbows that I talked about. It is likely that all of us really deep down inside want to see the whole of man promoted in a way that brings about more peace. That's just a natural desire. But we have to deal with reality. And I think, again, that's what makes this legislation, this political platform, such a hard sell for politicians. It is going to be highly politicized. There is going to be exaggeration on both sides talking about the costs or the ideology. And it's just something that is just going to divide not only this nation of the United States, but really the whole world. This is a global problem. And as I said, the cause of this problem, it's a character issue. It's a morality issue. And if we don't address the sins, as God says, then we're going to continue to struggle and fight. I mentioned before the break that there are some existing technologies out there that will help us to achieve the expansion of the energy needs. There are some sources that do provide electrical generation that don't emit carbon byproducts into the atmosphere. But those two come with a huge, huge risk. And in fact, it was that risk that I had been thinking about for the last month or so and have watched quite a few documentaries about the various nuclear accidents that have taken place over the history of the use of nuclear power. It's been about 50 years now, I guess. Actually, probably about 70 years that we've been tampering with these forces. So is nuclear power generation an option? Is nuclear energy the answer? Well, the energy crisis of the 1970s and even into the 60s created these problems where the United States and the developing nations were threatened by a cutoff from hostile forces to them, a cutoff of their energy. And we saw the repercussions. You remember the long gas lines. You remember back then we weren't as efficient in the use of energy. And so the stranglehold that different nations hold over others, it really does provide a huge obstacle. It does lead to war. Energy is required by all societies. So along comes nuclear power generation. And in a way, it kind of seemed like the new messiah, right? They're clean emissions. The nuclear power plants were able to essentially plug into the existing power distribution grid. They were expensive, in a sense, to install, but they had very limited operational expense. Just how widespread is nuclear power in the United States? I want to quote to you from the Nuclear Association report from, it's December 2018. It says, Nuclear Power in the United States, that's the title. It says, the United States is the world's largest producer of nuclear power, accounting for more than 30% of worldwide nuclear generation of electricity. So here the United States is the greatest user. This report says the country's nuclear reactors produce 805 billion kilowatt hours in 2017, or 20% of our total electrical output. There are two reactors under construction currently. So 20% of all the electricity used in the United States is generated by nuclear power. That's a substantial amount. They say government policies changed since the late 1990s have helped pave the way for significant growth in nuclear capacity. Well, something happened prior to 1990 that caused this new messiah to be reconsidered. You might remember the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. You might remember some of the other nuclear accidents that I'll refer to at the end. Currently, the United States has 98 operating nuclear power reactors in 30 different states. So it is widespread. It is numerous. Maybe you knew, maybe you didn't. I didn't know we had close to 100 nuclear power plants in operation. After the accident at Three Mile Island, it really spooked the industry. It spooked the government. The reality of what we were dealing with, again, caused pause. And subsequent to that, basically a stoppage of constructing new reactors. And so what we have now is an aging technology. The infrastructure is there, but it's aging, and some of it needs to be decommissioned, but there's not a replacement in sight. So what are we to do? There's a statistic, or you can look at the average capacity factor, which basically says, well, how reliable is the energy production source? Well, nuclear power basically runs 93% of the time. It's that reliable. 93% of the time that you need power from that plant, you're getting it uninterrupted. If you compare that to wind generation, they're only reliable 35% of the time. So you either outstrip the number of nuclear power plants about threefold to keep the same level of continuous energy, or you build more nuclear plants. Nuclear is more efficient, but it carries with it a huge, huge risk to mankind. There are other technical issues that hold back the wind and solar battery technology, transmission inefficiencies from point to point. All of these really diminish the effectiveness of wind and solar. What's interesting in looking at this study as well is they say the average nuclear generation costs have come down quite a bit. It looks to be about 15% from when they built these plants to where they are now. They become more efficient. Nuclear power generation says, despite a near halt in new construction of more than 30 years ago, U.S. reliance on nuclear power has grown. It's unsustainable, right? They need more electric generation from nuclear power. They need alternative sources than fossil fuels if they're going to address climate change and carbon emissions. Let me read you a quote from the United States and Britain in Prophecy. And think about what Mr. Armstrong has to say here. This is, I think, in the first 10 pages of the book. He warns us, men today are tampering with forces of nature. They lack prudence, knowledge, ability, and wisdom to control. Men today are tampering with those natural forces like nuclear energy. The problem is, it might seem like they've got it figured out, but they lack prudence, right? There's an economic push to be more efficient, which can lead to more recklessness. There's a lack of knowledge. There's a lack of ability. And there's definitely a lack of wisdom to control. There are byproducts to nuclear power generation. I want to just get a couple quotes from Mr. Armstrong. He gave a sermon back in June 1982, and the title of his sermon was "The Unthinkable Will Happen." We'll start with clip number 4.
Brethren, I don't think we realize, number one, I don't think we realize how great and how powerful is the hydrogen bomb and the kind of weapons that are available now. I don't think we really understand and realize it. I don't think it ever sinks completely in. It would horrify you if you do.
Really a thought-provoking quote. It's easy for us so far removed from nuclear accidents. Even what happened in Japan was very dramatic to watch. We're so far removed from World War II and the use of nuclear weapons. And yet today, we've reported on it a lot. The new technology, the Great Satan missile that can blow up the state of Texas, one missile. And we see nuclear proliferation. And we see discussions today with President Trump and North Korea trying to deal with this nuclear weapon issue. There are real problems. Pakistan and India are once again firing weapons into Kashmir region. The Pakistanis shut down their airspace because they allegedly shot down a couple Indian warplanes. Both are nuclear powers. Do they have the wisdom to control, the knowledge, the prudence? You see, that's a significant risk that we face. I want to play another clip from that same sermon by Mr. Armstrong. We'll go ahead with clip 5.
But men don't know how to work together. They don't get along together. Everyone is thinking of what he can get, and usually from the other. And there's always a case of competition, a matter of jealousy and envy toward others, of strife, leading to violence. And violence is increasing rapidly right now all over the world. And men are trying to live without God. And this world has been built without God. But it has been built, influenced, and guided by Satan the devil. And we're in such a world now. And God is not going to end this world until the world has come to see that it's had 6,000 years and it's tried everything. And as long as man would say, oh, if you'd just given us another few days or weeks or months, or maybe years, we would have solved our problems. I tell you, the great of the world think they're still going to solve the problems of the world. They don't admit they're so absolutely that they can't solve the problems. They think we're going to make this a better world some way. We're going to solve all these problems. Well, they've been trying it for the last 6,000 years, and it's getting worse and worse, and they're getting farther and farther away from solutions. Farther and farther away from solutions.
How true that is. How sad. That is the human experience. That is the lesson that mankind needs to learn. As I said, this legislation is not new. These concepts have been tried over and over in the past. It's a matter of getting back to God. This world is cut off from God's knowledge. It's cut off from God's solutions. But that time is soon to change. Well, I've kind of run out of time. I do have a couple minutes to just share with you some thoughts that I had, again, about this whole energy crisis and watching the results of man's attempt to work with nuclear power, trying to have something that's reliable, something that's affordable. I could talk to you and read to you some horror stories Three deadly nuclear accidents in Russia, America, and Japan. These developed nations that have other resources, you could argue. I guess Japan, not so much. But you might better remember these locations as Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima. There is quite a risk associated with using nuclear energy. Of course, there is the catastrophic damage of exploding a nuclear warhead in a populated area. And even there, all of the tests that were done in the past and the damage that that's done to our atmosphere, to our planet. Nuclear power is really something that does require godly discernment, godly discretion in how it's used. Some of the videos that I watched, the documentaries or the books that I've read that describe the problems that the nuclear engineers or the plant operators went through at a time of crisis. And I couldn't help to think that a lot of these problems were caused by vanity. In Chernobyl, the deputy director of the Russian Atomic Agency, I don't have his proper title, I'm just kind of going off memory here, but he was the second in command, and the Russians were trying to run a test because the Israelis had already bombed a reactor similar to the one that was in Chernobyl. And what the Russians were trying to do was to make sure that they could wind down their reactors in case of an attack, still generate enough power to prevent the core from melting down. And so in vanity, the test called for a 40% or 60% reduction in power, I forget which. But the engineer, the deputy there, brought it down over 90%. They actually stopped the reaction and then in haste to bring it back online and to run this test, disaster started to happen. And it was becoming increasingly clear that they were dealing with something they did not know how to handle. There's a book, it's a Nobel, it's a best-selling book, Pulitzer Prize. Sorry, that's what I was looking for. A Pulitzer Prize winning book about the voices of Chernobyl. And it covers a lot of the stories of the firefighters' families that as they lived close to Chernobyl and they were trained and prepared to fight fire there, they never expected to have to fight what they got into. Many of them rushed off in the middle of the night. They heard the explosion of the reactor. They saw the flames at the building. And so they rushed there, didn't don the proper equipment to protect themselves. As they approached the building, the street was melting in front of them, sticking to their shoes, and they couldn't figure out why the fire was in front of them. How could the heat get that far out? They were walking into radiation. By the time that the families got there to check on their spouses, by the time they were allowed through, they were already starting to have to evacuate the firefighters for severe radiation poisoning. Days later, perhaps weeks later, they died a horrific death. Their clothes were radioactive. And as you study the government response, they knew that a tragic, perhaps catastrophic event was unfolding before them. How do you stop a meltdown? How do you stop a release of radiation, a potent release of radiation that could kill thousands, if not millions of people? Well, they had to think about it and deal with it. Three Mile Island in the United States, our worst nuclear disaster there. I don't think it resulted in any immediate deaths. And it was only a small release of radiation, as I understand, into the atmosphere. And yet they were just moments away from catastrophic release as well. Fukushima, they built protection around their plants that they thought was adequate to hold back any natural disaster. And yet a disaster came and it quickly overwhelmed their systems and led to a tremendous release and an ongoing problem for the environment. There are quite a few risks and side effects associated with using nuclear energy. The Green New Deal, in a way, wants to take us to utopia. And again, that's laudable. But mankind does not know how to get there. We don't have the money. We don't have the technology. And there's certainly no cooperation among the nations. As I said before, this is a character issue. And until mankind submits to God and to his give way of life, none of what the conservatives or the liberals, what they're looking for, none of that is going to come to pass. We have to deal with the cause. Mankind does not have the solutions, but God does. We simply have to look to Him. We can study our history of failure, and we can pray and should pray that God will bring peace and equity to all. And you know what? That's prophesied in Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. I'll just grab a few highlights from this verse, or these two verses. It says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder." The titles that are given to this son are absolutely inspiring. Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Eternal of Hosts will perform this. God is the solution, and he executes that solution through government, through the throne of David, and it leads to abundance, and it leads to equity, and it leads to peace. That is, after all, God's purpose. God is not the author of confusion, and he is bringing solutions. May he speed that day. Well, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. It's been fantastic being here at Edstone. I am looking forward to getting back to Edmond. But please, please be sure to listen tomorrow for Mr. Stephen Fleury's interview with Melanie Phillips. That will certainly be probably one of our best programs ever. So be sure, if you have time, to send in feedback to td@kpcg.fm. This is Andrew Locher signing off. Thank you for listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Program.